The CMU podcast in association with 7 Digital.
This week, fake artists, fake t-shirts and fake radio. It's the CMU podcast, looking back at the last week in the music business. I'm Andy Malt. With me is Chris Cook. Hello, Chris.
Hello.
How are you?
I'm good.
You've been to Romania.
I went to Romania. It was a very good event. It was called Mastering the Music Business. It was the second year, quite a lot bigger than last year. A conference, I mean, really aimed at the local music industry, so that the music community in Romania. But very interesting for me to learn about the music business in that part of the world. And then obviously myself and a few other people were over from the UK telling them about the music industry here. So yeah. It was a good event.
So there's the update on where Chris has been this week.
One thing I did learn on my way back from the event in Bucharest in Romania is if you're at the airport, you know, at the airport when you're queuing up for things, they have all those zigzags.
No, I never get to go anywhere.
You've been to an airport. At least once in
your life.
You're
the one who goes to things.
You've been to an airport. And all right then, you know, in a post office, when you're queuing, they have all those zigzag lines with all the sort of the barriers in the way.
No, my local post office is in the back of a shop.
You can imagine what I'm talking about.
No, I
about.
Can't imagine it.
At the station, because it was actually at the station at Gatwick Airport. And you've been to a railway station because you came on a train today.
Yeah, all right.
So I know you've been to a railway station. And they have the zigzags by the ticket machines or the ticket office. And they have all the barriers that you have to go round and then back and then back and then round and then back and then round.
Yeah.
You're picturing this.
Mm-hmm.
Well, if you get to the ticket queue and actually a whole sort of two bits of that conglomeration is unnecessary because the queue isn't going all the way round.
Yeah.
And so you would have to go much further than you need to.
Yeah.
And you think to yourself...
Is this going to be interesting soon?
No. Right. And you think to yourself... I could just sneak under the barrier here and be right at the end of the queue because I'm already panicking because my Oyster card didn't have any money on it. So now I'm having to get my train ticket and I'm going to miss my train and then blah.
Yeah.
When you do that, remember that you're wearing a rucksack.
Yeah.
So that you don't get trapped
that
under
could
the
be
barrier.
Embarrassing, couldn't it?
And then rely on other people to come and lift the barrier up so you could get through. Because although I didn't have a particularly big rucksack, it was quite thick. And so everything I did, it didn't fix the process.
You'd think the amount of travelling you do, you would... No, not to do that.
But thank you to the people who, after laughing at me, did then pick the barrier up and rescue me. And hence I'm here. Otherwise, I would still be at the Gatwick Airport train station trying to wrestle my way out of a barrier that was trapped on my rucksack.
Well, that's good. That's added a little bit of colour to the start of this week's podcast.
We all learn lessons.
But we have to get on, don't we?
I'm sharing it.
Because once again, Chris's got to rush off and do something.
Yeah.
And we've got a lot to talk about.
I have a CMU Insight session with the BPI to do this afternoon. But that has already happened by the time you hear this podcast.
Yeah.
It happened last week.
Yeah.
But there's another one coming up. So if you are an employee of a BPI member company, so one of the many, many labels who are members of the BPI, I think you can get in for free. Come to my next one, which I think is in 2 weeks' time. But yeah, we have got a lot to squeeze in before I have to vacate the studio and head towards the river.
Go swimming?
No, the BPI's offices are next to the river, not in the river.
Oh, of course.
They're next to the river.
That makes more sense.
Yes.
Anyway, coming up this week, we've got Kylie and Kendall Jenner being sued for printing their own faces over Tupac's. We've got a local radio station being intruded by a wanker. But first, we're going to talk about... The massive problem of fake artists on Spotify.
Fake artists!
Oh, fake artists!
There are fake artists.
It's been the big news this week, which...
Everywhere.
Or in fact, last week now, when this podcast goes
out. It'll probably still be this week as well. People won't shut up about this story,
won't.
Will they?
It's something that has been discussed a lot in the last week for various reasons. It's something CMU has not covered because we deemed it very early on to not be news or a story. But it is interesting in some ways.
Yes,
so... We thought this would be the place to discuss it.
It did seem to us from the off to be a bit of a non-story. So as you say, that's why we didn't cover it. Other journalists at various publications have since been digging. And as far as I can see, the more they dig, the more they confirm that it's a non-story.
Yes.
But it's now a non-story that pretty much every newspaper in the world seems to have reported on.
Yes. Because
that's journalism for you.
The term fake artist artists is sort of, it's eye-catching, isn't it?
And well, it fits in.
It sounds like a big deal.
It fits into the whole fake news conversation,
yes.
Doesn't it? And in the same way that everybody these days, whenever they see a little bit of biased journalism, which is most journalism,
yes,
they call it fake news. And it's like, it's not fake news, it's biased journalism. And okay, some journalism is more biased than others. And maybe some journalism is too biased. But that doesn't mean it's fake. And in the same way, I think these fake artists, well, they're artists, aren't they? But
yeah,
anyway, we should backtrack. As you say, I think there are some interesting elements to this story as people have dug into this further and people have been talking about it on the social networks and various publications have been reporting on it. And it seems to me that the two interesting things that people have been talking about is how streaming services are licensed and how the royalties flow through the system, and how production music or library music is licensed and how the royalties work. And that sounds like copyright to me.
Yeah.
A copyright conversation. And regular listeners to the podcast will know we can't resist a good copyright conversation on the podcast. So even though we've not reported on this in the ZMU Daily, we are here to talk about it, as you said. So remind us where this kicked off, as in 10 days ago now.
Yeah. So Vulture published an article about scammers on streaming services and people who are gaming the system.
I mean, even then, scammers and gamers, they're musicians and producers and artists and songwriters who are looking for sneaky tricks.
Well, also, one of the people they featured, who obviously always gets featured in these articles, was Matt Farley, Moturn Media, who isn't a scammer. He's just written a lot of songs. And it's like, and he's making a small amount of money. Like, not enough. He makes his money doing commissions. What scammers doing commissions? Anyway, this is sort of digressing off.
It is. Although, I mean, if you're not familiar with Matt's output, we have talked about it on the podcast before. Also, you did an interview with him a few years ago now, which will be sitting somewhere on the website.
I wrote a very long article about him.
Perhaps
about his genius.
Perhaps you will link to it. Oh, that's right. You made him Artist of the Year one year. Is that what I'm thinking of?
Yeah.
Perhaps you will be kind enough to link back to that from the podcast notes.
Maybe I will.
So our readers can go and read up on that. And so he was doing that on iTunes. He's now doing it on Spotify. And it's basically just putting out huge numbers of tracks about every possible subject matter, including CMU's Andy Moulton, Chris Cook.
Yes.
But also subject matter that people might be searching for on iTunes and Spotify in the hope that they will search for, I don't know, Christmas cake or Independence Day.
School psychologists.
Or anything like that, ice cream, and one of his tracks will appear and then they'll listen to it.
And you'll listen to it and go, that's actually quite good. I'm glad I found that.
And he will make a little bit of money.
Yeah.
So it was those sorts of things that this article was about. But there was one particular scam that then got everybody talking.
Well, it was sort of an aside. I mean, it was saying that it claimed that Spotify was commissioning musicians to create music which it then owned, and so it didn't have to pay royalties to the labels. And that was based on an MBW article from a year ago, which made this claim.
And I suppose it's interesting because that article at the time, because I remember people talking about the original article last year when it was published, but at that point it was much more part of the whole, oh, Spotify's going to become a record company conversation. You know how people have been saying that for the last year? And I was quite adamant at a recent event that I moderated that Spotify is not going to become a record company. Everyone in the audience seemed to disagree with me, so we'll see who's right on that. But that article originally was very much framed in, oh, Spotify, they're already creating these sort of instrumental ambient chill out tracks themselves. What's to stop them signing up other artists so that they own the music, and that means they won't have to rely on Sony and Universal and Warner and all the indies for their supply of music. So that's where this article originally sat. But this time round, everyone sort of honed in on this fake artist thing and this idea that there were all these fake artists on Spotify who Spotify were pushing into their listeners' ears through their playlists.
Yes.
And that was stopping proper artists, real artists, from getting paid. And somewhere in all of that, there was a controversy.
Yes, somewhere. So Spotify came out and said, this is not true. We've never created an artist to hoodwink anyone. They denied it all. And then MBW published a list of 50 artists who only existed. Well, artists who appear to only exist on Spotify and have no other presence.
And
they'd only released, like, you know, maybe a couple of tracks that had plays in the millions.
And also some of them didn't seem to have tracks or indeed a presence anywhere else other than on Spotify.
Yeah.
So although we are officially rejecting, and we're not the first people to do this, the term fake artists.
Yeah.
I mean, to be fake, do you remember back in the iTunes days, and I assume this still does happen on Spotify, there were those companies and people who would put up either cover versions of tracks or sound-alike versions of tracks and then title them in such a way that you might think they were the original.
Yes.
And that happened on iTunes. I once downloaded what I thought was Aztec Cameras somewhere in my heart, and it wasn't.
Yeah.
It was a cover version. It was a cover version that sounded very like the original, but not quite.
Yes.
This is back in the heyday of iTunes.
Yes.
And I complained about that to iTunes, and they basically told me to fuck off. So they weren't that bothered about it. But I think that, you could say, that's fake. Because you're pretending to be something else.
Yes.
Passing off the legal term you would use.
Well, if you want to use Matt Farley's new example again, he does have a song called All About That Bass, about enjoying fishing bass.
I know, but here's a funny, rather than trying to confuse people. But that, I would say, okay, you could use the word fake for that. With these artists, they're just people who have put music into Spotify that is possibly designed to serve a specific function in Spotify that isn't really available anywhere else. So it was a curious list.
Yes.
These artists and the fact that they had these tracks on Spotify, some of which had, as you say, had millions of listens, but they didn't really have a presence any elsewhere. There was nothing fake about that, but I suppose it was curious. And I suppose that's why people then latched on to this story as the week progressed.
Yeah, like you say, lots of people have done lots of digging.
Trying to work out who those 50 artists
were.
Because
there are certain, like some of the artists have labels or publishers associated with their tracks on Spotify. A lot of them are self-released. And the ones that are self-released, it does look like that's one artist releasing under different names because the way they've probably released two tracks, like one in 2016, one in 2017, and that's it. And they've got all these plays. But like the way that it's all put together, it's like this really looks like it's the same person over and over again.
So it's one person who is putting all of these tracks or ambient chill out tracks on Spotify, but using a different artist name every time.
Yeah.
But that's not fake. That's just pseudonyms.
Yes.
Lots of artists, particularly producers, have pseudonyms. And okay, perhaps this person had a lot of pseudonyms and was only putting out a single track on each one. But it's not by any means unknown for artists and especially producers to put out tracks under different names for various different reasons.
Yes. And so one of the acts that it was uncovered that there was a production duo called Quiz and LaRossi, who are based in Sweden and have worked with lots of big pop stars, but they were releasing these tracks under assumed names, various different names on Spotify. Well, a lot of the tracks come from a series of compilations under the Keen brand, which is actually, turns out, is owned by Epidemic Sound when I did some digging into that. Which also, they have those on YouTube as well, though that's the one where it's not their only presence is on Spotify. You can find these compilations on YouTube as well. And actually, if you go onto those compilations, some of those artists on those compilations are artists who don't seem to exist anywhere else. Some of them are actually named artists who have just done some production music and it's got onto this compilation. So there's a mix on there. So we can see that that is happening, but why is it happening? That's a good question, an interesting question.
So why are these people pumping this music predominantly into Spotify, maybe elsewhere, but predominantly into Spotify? It's all the similar music, isn't it? It's instrumental, yeah. it's chill out, it's ambient.
Yeah, if you look at the playlists that this music is on, it's generally, it's not like Spotify has created these fake artists and is putting them into big pop playlists and everyone's being tricked into thinking that there's pop stars that don't exist. It's like instrumental piano music, music for concentration. Yeah, like you say, ambient, chill out sort of stuff.
The stuff you used to buy on CDs stuff in the pound
actually,
shop.
Like clearly, like playlists have clearly got popular because people want music for concentration. I know, like when I see people creating playlists, it's often like I'm creating a playlist to concentrate while I'm working. And so those have become popular playlists that Spotify pushes and then means that Spotify has to keep kind of updating those with new music. And possibly there's just not enough music of that type to keep refreshing those playlists. And as a result, it is possible that Spotify as a company, or whoever curates those playlists has complained.
The thankless task of putting together.
In the pub has said, you know what's really annoying? There's just not enough music to keep refreshing these playlists. And someone's gone, oh, that's interesting. I could create some that would fill that playlist. Now, that may have been a conversation between someone at Spotify and that producer. It may just be that someone has spotted that gap, or various people have spotted that gap.
I suppose a few of the people who are known to be creating this content are based in Stockholm.
Yes.
Where Spotify have quite a lot of people, it being their home city. So therefore, it could be that either a formal conversation took place, or as you say, an informal conversation took place. Spotify remain adamant that they've not officially commissioned this music and they don't own this music. They are licensing it in from various different places. But as you say, it may be that the artists, the producers, the labels who are providing this content have been told by Spotify, we want this content. Or as you also say, they just spotted it I suppose the other question people were asking is, why are these artists who we've never heard of, some of whom have only put out a handful of tracks under that name, or one track under that name, the reason why that some of those tracks have got millions of plays is because they have been playlisted in official Spotify playlists that already have a big audience. And so there was like, well, why is Spotify selecting this? And I suppose that moved on to the next part of this conversation. So firstly, it was, well, does Spotify own this music and therefore they don't have to pay labels any royalties? And so that's why they're playlisting this music. When we got to the point where most people were buying Spotify's official line that they hadn't commissioned this music, that they didn't own it, then the conversation moved on to, well, perhaps there's some deal behind the scenes, which means it's cheaper to license this music than music that's coming in from a major record company or one of sort of the big established indies. And so it moved on to the conversation being, oh, Spotify are deliberately playlisting this music, not because they have an editorial gap, which I actually think in this case is what it is.
Yeah.
It's just that they have these playlists. They've turned out to be very popular. Not many mainstream artists are making music for these playlists. And so it's an editorial need that Spotify are playlisting these. But then there was, as I say, the separate conversation, which was, oh, have they done some sort of deal either directly with these artists or with a label or a music library that represents these artists so that these tracks are cheaper to license? And that is why Spotify are prioritising them, because then they save money.
Yes. And, well, yeah, they probably have done a direct deal with certain companies like Epidemic Sound, but they've done direct deals with all the labels. That's the result of the labels removing themselves from the collective licensing system and saying, we want to do direct deals because we think we can get better rates. Well, then you can't be surprised if someone else comes in and goes, well, we can do a cheaper deal and give you lower rates.
And a logical conclusion of that might be, I mean, I don't think that is what's happening here, because actually, in the scheme of Spotify's business at the moment, the money they would be saving is negligible versus the database they would need to be able to say, oh, this track's cheaper to stream than this track.
Yes.
But the way the music industry has set up the streaming business, it may well be we get to a point where streaming services do prioritize a track because it is cheaper to service than another track, because that is the way not Spotify has chosen to set up this business, but the music industry has, which I suppose brings us to the copyright conversation, the way Spotify is licensed and the way the royalties flow. And I'm sure we've talked about this before on the podcast in the context of dissecting the digital dollar. But basically what happens at the end of every month is Spotify does two things in every country and for every product type. So it would do this separately for free versus premium versus mobile bundle. But what they do at the end of the month is they say, OK, how much money did we make? And how many streams were there? So there were, I don't know, 10 million streams. That would probably be a rubbish month. But there were 10 million streams. And they'll say, OK, of all the tracks that streamed, 25% were of Universal controlled recordings. OK, music controlled by Universal Music. So all that money that we made, we are going to allocate 25% of the money to Universal Music's catalogue. We're going to say this is money that was generated by Universal's catalogue. And then we're going to go to our deal with Universal, which will be ultimately a rev share deal. And their contract with Universal Music will say, any income that is allocated to your catalogue, we will share that income with you. And the original major label deals were 60-40 to the label's advantage. We now know it's less than that. It'll be somewhere in the 50s. But we will give you X percent of the money, and so we'll pay that to Universal, and then we keep what's left. And then they repeat that equation with Sony and with Warner and with Merlin and all the independent distributors. Then that's only the recording rights, remember? So they then have to repeat it with all the major publishers and with the collecting societies, and they hand over all that money. And then the hope is, at the end of all of that, about 30% of the money is left on the table.
Which is not the case.
Because there are minimum guarantees, which we're not going to talk about because that's not relevant to this story. But the point is, every record company, every distributor, every publisher, every collecting society has negotiated its own deal, and they will all be on a slightly different revenue share. So that means some tracks and some songs are more expensive to stream than others. And you mentioned the collective licensing system here. So on the publishing side, the song copyright side, quite a lot of it does actually go through the collective licensing system.
Yeah.
The big five do their Anglo-American repertoire direct. In recordings, it all done through direct deals. Every label, every distributor has their own deal, and all those deals are slightly different. The labels could have done it through the collective licensing system. They could, in the UK, have said to PPL, you license this. And if it goes through the collective licensing system, then everybody is paid the same. Every track costs the same to the service provider. Every song costs the same. And so what people earn is based not on the deal that their label or distributor did, but on how many times their track or song was streamed. But that's not how the streaming business is done, certainly not on the recording side. And so some tracks are more expensive to stream than others. So it may well be down the line, the services start to say, we're going to prioritize the tracks which are cheaper for us to stream. And they are perfectly entitled to do that if they so wish. Obviously, the constraint being, if they filled all their playlists with cheap and cheerful Muzak, everyone would stop listening to the playlist. So there is a constraint there.
Yes. So, yeah, that's it. The music has to be good. You can't say, oh, these fake artists are creating fake music and they're filling up these playlists with music that people want to listen to. And it's a scandal.
But you mentioned Epidemic Sound.
Yes.
And they are, in essence, what we would call production music or library music.
Yes.
And so those are companies who provide lots of generic music. And they're really there for the TV business and the movie business and the gaming business and the ad industry.
They're particularly used on YouTube.
Well, Epidemic Sound in particular, because yes. of their business model. But production music in general...
Production music in general, yeah.
...is generally used as an alternative to synchronising a commercially released track.
Yeah.
So in the sync game, you either sync a commercially released track or you use production music. And the reason you would use production music is it is easier to license. Because these music libraries, and in the main, the music libraries are controlled by music publishers, even though they are recording catalogues, and obviously publishers don't usually deal in recordings. But in production music, it is generally the music publishers who own these libraries of music. And it is easier and cheaper to license production music versus sync. That's not to say you can usually do it in a single license. You can't. And this is where Epidemic Sound is an exception.
Yes.
Actually, most library music is licensed through the collective licensing system. So in the UK, you would license the actual synchronization of the production music into your video with an MCPS license, the Mechanical Rights Society. And then every time your video then went out on TV or in a cinema, you would then have to pay performing right royalties through PRS.
Yeah.
Then you have companies like Audio Network, who are not part of MCPS. So with Audio Network, you do the initial deal directly with Audio Network, but you still have to pay the PRS. However, on neither of those scenarios do you have to pay a label for the recording. So that's why it's easier. You still have to deal with publishers or the Publishers Collecting Society, but you don't have to deal with a record company. So it's less deals and therefore less money. And then you have Epidemic Sound, which is the music library that it seems that a lot of these ambient chill-out tracks that Spotify or playlisting has come from. And Epidemic Sound is interesting in that it completely sits outside of the collective licensing system.
Yeah.
So not only do you not need to do a label deal and a publishing deal, you don't need to worry about mechanicals and performing, you don't need an MCPS license or a PRS license. When you pay Epidemic Sound some money, you can then use that without having to do a deal with anyone else. So it's all the rights are in the license. And that's why it is popular with YouTubers. Because what YouTubers don't like is that when they use commercially released music or even some production music in their videos, there's always a risk that some label or publisher or collecting society will come out of the woodwork through Content ID and say, that's our music. And then either block the video or grab the advertising income. And YouTubers desperately don't want that to happen. So they like Epidemic Sound because unusually it is all of the rights in one single, relatively cost-efficient license. So there is no label, no publisher, no collecting society. It is all there. And what is interesting, I suppose, is Epidemic Sound wasn't set up to provide music to something like Spotify, but they have done a license with it. In terms of people doing it under pseudonyms, I mean, I suppose there is one thing with Epidemic Sound that... If you're a PRS member, you can't make music for Epidemic Sound. You can't sell music to Epidemic Sound. Because as a PRS member, you have given PRS the exclusive rights to represent the performing rights in every song you ever write.
Yeah.
And so you can't go to Epidemic Sound and say, here's a piece of music I wrote, and you can buy all of the copyright elements in this music. Because as a writer, you can't give them your performing rights.
Yes. And so maybe that is where... This does become an interesting story because one of the reasons we rejected this as a story in the first place was that artists have always been making music for production libraries under pseudonyms, either because they just don't want people to know that that's what they're doing or because it's sort of outside the style of music they normally make. It doesn't fit in, so they don't want it to be linked up, even though like if you went and did a search on the PRS database or whatever, you would find out who was making that music. But to the public, they're not going to see that, oh, this person's done a song and I want to be a completist.
And also, Except when a library starts putting music into Spotify, usually library music is only being used by movie studios and music supervisors who don't really care who it's made by.
Yeah.
And so given that you don't necessarily want to confuse your B2B output with your consumer output, yeah, you use a pseudonym because when it comes to library music, most people will never know that that's the name you're using. And even the people who know generally don't care.
However, if an artist who has an agreement with PRS is making music for Epidemic Sound and putting it out under a pseudonym, then there is a slight scandal, potentially.
Yeah, that's a conspiracy theory, because we don't know that that is happening.
No.
But you're right, that would be a dodgy reason for using a pseudonym rather than a normal reason for using a pseudonym.
Yeah.
Is if you're a member of PRS, and this is true for most of the collecting societies in the world, the US is the exception here, because when you join BMI or ASCAP in the US, you grant them a non-exclusive right to represent your performing rights. But most other societies work like PRS. So as a PRS member, as a SACEM member, as a gamer member, as a STIM member in Sweden, you couldn't give or sell music to Epidemic Sound for that reason. So that would be a slightly dodgy reason for using a pseudonym. So you could be selling music into Epidemic Sound, breaching the rules of your collecting society. We don't know that is going on, but it would be the one part of this story that would be, I mean, on another level, if a writer wants to sell music to Epidemic Sound, they should be allowed to bloody well sell their music to Epidemic Sound. The societies would say they're protecting the writers from potential business partners who will try and force them to give up rights they shouldn't give up. So the societies, I think, are coming from a good place. But, you know, writers should be free to do whatever they want to do. But that's the potential dodgy bit of this. But I suppose what is interesting is that Epidemic Sound, who created this library not for Spotify at all, are now bringing in extra revenue from Spotify. And the statement that they have given, because usually with something like Epidemic Sound as a writer, it's a buyout. You get paid a chunk of money up front, and then the library then can do whatever they like with the music. But they are saying that their license with Spotify is different to the licenses they would do with a film studio or a YouTuber. It's more like a conventional Spotify deal. And the artists are sharing in any income with those million streamed tracks. Although, it would not surprise me at all if the rev share arrangement on that agreement, even though the structure is the same as a Universal deal or a Sony deal, the rev share is much more favourable to Spotify, which means that ultimately they could come to favour this music down the line, as we have explained. But, as we also said, it seems to me at the moment, it is just that actually, when you're looking for this sort of ambient, chill-out background music, libraries, who we tend to look down on library music, don't we? Which is one of the reasons why producers use a pseudonym. Because we're all conditioned to, oh, library music, that's a bit shit, isn't it? But actually, for these sorts of playlists, library music has all the gems.
People have been talking this up as a scandal, have said, oh, this is fake artists doing real artists and music companies out of money. But as we've shown, it's real artists making the music and real music companies who are putting it out there. So the money's still coming back into the music industry and going to artists who make music.
And I think in the original Vulture article, all the people they were saying were gaming the music industry. Well, in my head, all of those people are in the music industry. So it's just fair game, isn't it?
Yeah. But if you want fake artists, you need to go on to the next thing that's going to happen, which we've discussed in various forms in the last year, is AI music.
Yeah, when the computers, machines...
Computers making the music. No artist involved at all. Then where are you?
So at that point, you're right. If those machines pretend to be human beings, then that's a bit fake. And indeed, as this conversation has rumbled on over the week, that AI element has been noted. And what is the future? It is a conversation that has been ongoing for a while now. We talked about it with our panels at MIA's Meltdown.
Yes.
Earlier this year, we had a great panel with Ed Newton Rex, who is a composer and songwriter who has set up this startup called Duke Deck, which is creating AI that can create music. And with Dr. Mick Grierson from Goldsmiths College, who has a whole department of people doing interesting stuff in this space. So they were our AI experts on the panel.
Yeah.
Then there was me, and there was Brittany Bean from Tracks 2, who we have had on the podcast before. And so we were discussing all of that. And I asked the question. I said, particularly to Ed, who's a composer by trade,
yeah,
I said, are you building technology which will ultimately render you and your compositions redundant? And both Mick and Ed seemed convinced that, their line was very much that, no, the AI provides new tools. It will enable innovative songwriters and producers to do kinds of music we've never thought of before. But ultimately, human beings will always need to be involved. Although I'm not so convinced, and Brittany was likewise. I don't think AI is going to completely replace humans in this process for a long time. But I think, well, you could argue some pop and dance music, the machine is already doing quite a bit of the work. Okay, a producer might be pulling it together. So I can see in the relatively near future that certain kinds of music, like this ambient chill-out music, could be machine-generated. But I think human beings will be involved in music-making for some time, although eventually...
Well, everything will be done by machines eventually, and we'll all be out of jobs.
Do you think podcasts about music business news will be done by machines before...
I think a machine could do what we do very easily.
Well, perhaps we'll look into that. Perhaps we could render ourselves redundant and have a machine doing this. Of course, a really interesting thing about AI and music is at what point will machines start making music for other machines to listen to?
Yeah.
And that's where AI gets both very exciting and incredibly scary. But anyway... There are no fake artists on Spotify was the big headline this week in the music business.
Right, still to come, we've got some good old-fashioned pirate radio and some news in brief. But now let's talk about some fake T-shirts, which were T-shirts you could buy for $125.
They were real T-shirts.
Yes.
There was an actual T-shirt. But this is actually a story that began a couple of weeks ago, but it's risen up our news agenda because it has now gone properly illegal. But remind us how this began.
So Kendall and Kylie Jenner, who are people, that's all I have to say on that. I don't really know who they are,
but,
other than that they're famous. And they can sell T-shirts for $125.
We did obviously cover Kylie Jenner when she was competing with Kylie Minogue for the Kylie trademark.
And Kendall Jenner when she was in that Pepsi advert.
That terrible Pepsi advert they had to pull. So they have both appeared in CMU before, even though we still don't really know who they are.
Yes, but then recently they have merch because they're famous and they put these T-shirts on sale, as I said, $125 each. And basically they were like, all the T-shirts had like classic music artwork on them and then they'd printed either their faces or other, like there was one I think that had a screen grab of an Instagram post over the top of that.
So they took classic rock, pop, hip-hop T-shirts that had either artwork or photographs that we had probably seen before as album artwork or whatever. And then over the pop star's face, they put either their face or something else Jenner-related.
Well, just, I mean, it was just a print over the whole thing, not obscuring faces necessarily, just kind of obscure. I guess it's supposed to be saying, like, these are the new famous people.
We didn't know what it was.
More said, there are some famous people you remember who did some good stuff, and here are some people who, I don't know, one of them was an advert.
But the Jenner-related images were just randomly, it would look like you got a Tupac Shakur T-shirt and then someone put a Kylie Jenner sticker on top of it, is what it would look like.
Which is basically what what they did.
As it turns out. So initially, people were outraged about this, not really for copyright reasons, just because they were taking legendary musicians and then sticking their silly faces on it and people thought that that was disrespectful.
And also they'd got no approval to do that. So that was the big scandal initially. So they got the cease and desist letters from the representatives of the Doors and from the estate of Notorious B.I.G., both of whom were featured on these T-shirts. And as a result, they withdrew them from sale and issued an apology saying, these designs were quite poorly thought out. Didn't mean to disrespect anyone. Didn't mean to offend anyone. We're not selling these T-shirts anymore. Let that be the end of it.
Bye.
Bye. But then a photographer who's done a lot of kind of classic, particularly hip-hop photography, Mike Miller, sued over the use of one of his images on a Tupac T-shirt. And he said basically, one, they hadn't sought approval for use of that photo, so that's one reason he's suing. And the other one, he didn't really want to be associated with people who seem to be best known for PR disasters. So that lawsuit is going through the motions at the moment. They have issued a response. Actually, there have been various responses. One is that he's suing the Jenner sisters directly, and they've said that's not really fair because beyond approving the designs, they don't administrate the brand. They would expect that someone in their team would do all the licensing stuff. They just say, that looks good, do it. And then the company that actually does control the brand, it's the, I don't know what the brand's called, Kylie and Kendall, I think, K&K. And the company's called Canada Inc. And they issued a statement saying, you can't do us on this because all we did was get some old T-shirt stock, which is why they had so many different T-shirt designs in terms of the original T-shirts. Got some old T-shirt stock and we just printed over the top of them and that was a design. There's no approval needed there because we already had the license to sell those T-shirts.
So this creates some interesting copyright questions. So it was interesting, the initial cease and desists were by the artists whose images were used. But the lawsuit was by one of the photographers who controls the copyright in the photo that was disrupted with the Jenner sisters' faces. And so basically what the T-shirt company are saying is, well, we didn't make any copies of the original photography because that had already been printed on the T-shirts with a license.
Yeah.
All we did was print some stuff on top. So we didn't need a license to make copies. And so, well, that's interesting. On one level, they're probably right. But then on another level, there's all sorts of other issues there, which includes in the US, you also have image rights as well as copyright. Now, having said that, that wouldn't be the photographer's right. That would be Tupac's image rights. So it would be the Tupac estate who would sue under image rights. So is there a case under copyright? In the UK and much of Europe, we have moral rights, a whole other area of copyright. And one of the moral rights, here in the UK, there aren't many moral rights, but one of them is derogatory treatment of your work. And I think that probably under that, you could say this was a derogatory treatment of my work. I don't want Kylie Jenner's face slapped on my gorgeous photo. And you probably could do it as a moral rights case in Europe, but you don't really have moral rights under US copyright law. And also, the Jenners might go for a fair use, First Amendment, blah, blah, blah defense. So from an intellectual property point of view, there's lots of diagrams to be drawn. As it currently stands, photographer definitely thinks his rights have been infringed. T-shirt company are convinced they're in the clear.
Yes, so we'll see. That case is clearly going to keep rolling on. So maybe we'll come back to that in the future. Okay, just quickly time for some news in brief now. This is, by the time you hear this podcast, it's quite old news, but it happened after the last podcast was recorded. So let's mention it here. But SoundCloud has cut 173 jobs and closed its London office. It's now going to just operate from Berlin and New York.
Yes, that story broke about 12 minutes after we recorded the last podcast. So very sad for all of those people. That's about 40% of the workforce. So it's a significant downsizing. Not necessarily a surprise. I mean, it clearly was a surprise, and it was certainly a surprise for the people who worked there because they were under the impression that SoundCloud was turning a corner. That said, I mean, how many times last year did we talk about it being a make or break year for SoundCloud? So we know they are in a tricky position. They tried to spin this. Well, obviously, there's been lots of talk about, will somebody buy SoundCloud? In recent weeks, Deezer has been linked, presumably backed by Len Blavatnik, the owner of Warner, who's also a big shareholder in Deezer. They seem to be spinning this as, no, we don't want to be bought. We have an independent future, and we're downsizing to ensure our independent future. But most people I talk to now seem convinced they don't have an independent future, and it's either get bought or, well, go out of business. So anyway, drama at SoundCloud, and very sad for all those people who lost their jobs.
Yeah. The music industry has welcomed an EU committee votes on safe harbour reform.
Yes. If you wonder why there's been quite so many panels and speeches and open letters coming out from the music industry recently about safe harbour, it's because all of that safe harbour reform we've been talking about a lot on the podcast was being debated in the European Parliament last week in two of the committees of the European Parliament. Four committees of the European Parliament are considering the copyright reform in Europe. The Consumer Rights Committee did it last month, I think. Last week it was the Culture Committee and the Industry Committee. But actually, the Legal or Judicial Committee are leading on this. And so they will take all of the recommendations by these other committees and then make their own recommendations, which will then go to the rest of Parliament before EU Council get involved. There's still a long way to go on all of this. But there was a lot of developments in the Parliament this week, and the music industry seemed to think that the safe harbour article in the European Copyright Directive, which was a bit waffly, is going to get refined to the music industry's advantage to make it clearer that YouTube has some new liabilities. But we'll see.
We will see. Gangnam Style, no longer the most played video on YouTube.
Yeah, talking to YouTube.
Yeah, just shy of reaching the 3 billion play mark, and it's lost its title. It's now Wiz Khalifa and Charlie Puth's See You Again.
Has more plays.
It's gaining more quickly on that 3 billion plays.
So bad luck to Psy, although you said...
It had to happen eventually.
you said below the video on YouTube, the Psy fans are now coming out and saying, we should all watch this video on a loop. Try and get him back to the lead. So
I don't think it's going to happen.
Don't think it's going to happen. But anyway, that was another YouTube development this week. And as you said in your write-up of this, the fact that the most watched video was a music video and it has been beaten by another music video helps the music industry in their line. Because obviously YouTube, when the music industry are playing hardball, are always like, nah, music, not that important to YouTube. It's all about cats and kids talking about makeup. But I think this proves that the music video is quite substantial on YouTube in addition to all that other nonsense.
Anyway, so if you want to read all of those stories in full, go to completemusicupdate.com/podcast and you will find the show notes for this show where there will be links to them all. And finally this week, radio hacking, analog hacking. Bit of a change from all the digital hacking.
Old school music piracy.
Real old school music piracy.
On the back of this story, there was a video doing the rounds, which I think was on the Radio 4 Facebook profile, which was from the BBC News. The 6 o'clock news on the BBC used to be a programme called 60 Minutes back in the 80s. And they had a clip of a report from, I think, 1984, when a new bit of media regulation came into force. And it was all the pirate radio stations that existed in the early 80s. And there was like one guy who did a radio show for people somewhere in London out of his living room every night. But this new law was going to mean that he couldn't do it anymore. So yes, an old school pirate radio, sort of.
Yes, so this is what's happened is there's this local radio station in Mansfield called Mansfield 103.2, and 12 times in the last 3 months their broadcasts have been hijacked by someone who then just plays the Winkers song by Ivor Biggin, classic masturbation anthem. actually done by someone who used to be on That's Life.
Yes.
A bit of trivia.
Doc Cox, former TV journalist and comedy song person.
He did quite a lot.
He did, although this is the one he's best known for.
But Ivor Biggin isn't his real name, so he's a fake artist.
He is a fake artist. Spotify will be playlisting this one full on, I am sure. So I suppose when I used to listen to radio on FM in London, pirate radio, it's illegal, they're not paying PRS, PPL, blah, blah, blah. But there are some good pirate stations. But pirate radio is annoying when they broadcast on the same frequency as another station.
Yeah.
I remember back in the day when XFM was good, and I used to listen to XFM, and I used to live in North London, and there was a pirate station that every night at about 6 o'clock would start broadcasting basically on their frequency. And because their transmitter was closer to me, I couldn't listen to John Kennedy in the evening because it was this pirate station. So pirate radio is annoying when it interferes with existing streams. But usually that's a mistake. It's not that the pirate radio station is deliberately trying to stop XFM from broadcasting. Yeah. They just don't really know what they're doing and they press a button and they accidentally broadcast on that frequency. Whereas whoever is doing this, and we still don't know who it is deliberately jamming this radio station's frequency so that in the middle of some serious conversation, the wanker song starts playing.
Yes, and that's annoying the head of the radio station.
Who gave quite a sort of serious interview also on Radio 4.
Yeah, so it has various bits of coverage and various bits of the media. It was in The Sun. And yeah, the station's managing director, Tony Delahunty, he did an interview on the Today programme on Radio 4, where he was quite annoyed about it. And he said in this interview, like, you only need a small transmitter, and then if you can get near where they're doing an outside broadcast or where their own transmitter's broadcasting from, you can override it, you're on the air, and you can play this novelty song. And that's no good. And then he, you know, and obviously you might think that sounds quite funny that someone's doing this. He didn't think it was funny, but he conceded that some people might find that humorous. But he then said, what if it's a terrorist doing it? And they're putting out terrorist messages. I didn't think of that, did you? What if they're saying things that you don't want to hear that are bad? That was essentially what the interview said.
The best thing about this interview was he was basically making it sound like it was really easy to go and jam an FM radio station.
Yeah.
And anyone could go and do it. And then it was funny then reading...
Because then he actually, in the interview, he was saying, like, someone could come on and they could set up near the transmitter that's broadcasting the Today programme and they could cut in and then the Today programme's gone. But it's not happening to BBC stations, is it? It's happened to little Mansfield radio stations.
Well, it was happening to BBC stations in 1984, according to this 60
Minute
program.
Yeah.
But it was interesting that Ofcom, the media regulator who oversees the FM dial, then put out a statement basically going, no, this is really hard
this
to
is
do.
Very difficult. You need a very powerful transmitter to override the other transmitter, and you need some technical knowledge of how to actually do that. It's not something that anyone could just do, which sort of then does make it funnier that someone with that technical knowledge is then using it to do something so stupid.
But Ofcom was basically saying, hey, terrorists, this isn't something you should be thinking about. And meanwhile, whoever it is who's playing the wanker song, please stop.
Yes. I mean, that's why. Well, basically, so Teddy Dinahunty said one of the reasons he's doing lots of media about this is because he's hoping by getting out the word that it's illegal to do this, you could get a 2-year prison sentence for doing it, or at the very least a fine if you're caught, although he did also say it's very hard to catch the person doing it. He's hoping that that will scare them off and they'll stop doing it.
And everyone can have a jolly good laugh about it and then move on with their lives.
Yes.
And leave poor old Mansfield 103.2 FM to get on with its business as it wishes.
But the real fun bit of trivia I discovered while looking all this up...
Yeah, nothing to do with the radio station, but...
Is the Winkers song was released by Beggar's Banquet.
Yeah.
And it was an early hit for what became Beggar's Group, the biggest indie label in the world. And so basically, that is the reason that Adele is famous now.
Yeah, their first top 40 hit.
Yeah.
So there you go. Perhaps that's why this person is playing it. Perhaps it's a celebration of great British music.
I'm a wanker, and it does me good like it bloody well should. I'm a wanker, and I'm always pulling my pud. I was 25 years old before I was kissed, and then I found that I preferred a swift one off the wrist. It's cheap.
Yes.
So there you go. I really have to go, so do the wrap-up.
Okay. So that's all we've got time for on this week's CMU podcast. You should subscribe to the podcast. It was presented by me, Andy Malt, and Chris Cook, produced by Matt Peaty. And for more on CMU, you can go to completemusicupdate.com.
Recorded at Unique Facilities, the CMU podcast is an unlimited production in association with 7 Digital.